to our next item on this afternoon's agenda, which is 1223.
1223, amend Title 33, Planning and Zoning, to reduce regulatory restrictions and processes for short-term housing and mass shelters.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you all. Thank you very much. Okay, gentlemen, take it away.
Okay, good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Joe Zender with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I'm here with Phil Namony, who has been our lead on this project we're going to be presenting to you today. And just to mention some other staff members who put a lot of time into this, Leslie Lum, who's your North District Planner, Matt Wickstrom from the Bureau of Development Services, and Ben Morrow from the Mayor's Office. Carla, if we could get the presentation up.
Just while you're getting started, I guess I should put a couple things on the record here to begin with. As context, these folks are here reporting back to us because we declared a state of emergency last year, and then we gave direction to the Bureau in March to simplify our regulations and develop some code improvements and cut the red tape for siting shelters. There's still a huge need for shelters in our city. We've placed 562 new shelter beds in the last year. That's permanent shelter beds. That doesn't count some of the great temporary donations and opportunities that we've made use of. But obviously, that's real progress, and there's more work to be done. I just want to thank the council for making this a priority and thank the Bureau for fitting in yet another project in what's obviously a historically busy year with the residential infill project and the comp plan, among other things, on your agenda. But I'm glad that you took the emergency seriously and are now back to us with some specifics about how do we make this real.
Okay. Well, thank you. What we're going to be presenting today is the work that we have been done at your direction about how to remove unnecessary barriers from both the city code, specifically the zoning code, and some city practices. The work that we did was based on working with the providers of shelter, both small shelters and large shelters, and Home for Everyone. And really the question was, what are you encountering in these cities' codes and practices that, if they were removed, would make an actual difference, a significant and substantive difference? And what we heard is on this short list here. The first four of these items are affected by the zoning code, and they are addressed in the proposed changes that we're bringing to you today. Of course, we included public outreach in preparing this proposal, and here's just a brief summary of the kind of events as well as a hearing at the PSC that we conducted. Now I'm going to turn it over to Phil to walk us through the specifics of the proposal.
Afternoon, Phil Namony from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I'm going to focus on what the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommended as they moved the project forward to City Council. And their focus was on mass shelters, short-term housing, and transitional units. And I want to spend just a minute to kind of go over what each of those terms mean, because there is often confusion about those. In all of these cases, these are providing temporary housing. And so in the case of a mass shelter or short-term housing, the idea is that generally it's a temporary housing as an alternative to living on the streets. Folks tend to be there 30 days or less, and it's a process for them to be able to find services, to be able to move up to the next step. The main difference between a mass shelter and short-term housing is that a mass shelter is usually in a large area or a large room that's not necessarily divided, whereas a short-term housing can often look like motel rooms or even a house, but generally the folks are not required to stay there for more than 30 days. And then lastly, the Planning Commission made some amendments on how certain institutions could deal with transitional dwelling housing units as part of their use category. So we're going to start with some of the changes with mass shelters. Currently, there are actually a lot of zones where mass shelters are allowed by right, but there are some pretty significant limitations on those mass shelters. And so what this project did is reduce some of those limitations, made it a little bit easier for certain mass shelters in some zones to go by right, and increase the number of beds that could potentially be allowed by right. And the table on the screen shows some of the changes. What we noticed in talking to the providers was that generally the largest shelter really could be efficiently provided for was for 200 beds. And so in the most intense zones, that's what got proposed, EX and CX and CG zones, that we increase the number of beds that potentially could be allowed by right from 100 to 200. And we also reduced the separation requirements for shelters by right. Now,
what does that mean?
What that means is if they can't meet those, they can still go through a conditional use review. So it's not an either or. It's just that, for example, if there is already a shelter within, say, under the proposed regulations, if there's already another shelter within 600 feet, the new shelter would have to go through conditional use review. But it's basically an allowance, a condition that allows the shelters to go by right. So if, as I just mentioned, if shelters aren't able to go be proposed by right, there are we do have an allowance to allow them to apply for a conditional use review in most of our other zones. This includes the residential zones and also in the commercial employment zones if they can't meet the requirements by right. What we found was that this barrier of entry was fairly high because essentially even a small shelter would have to go through a Type 3 conditional use review, which required a pre-application conference and a hearing. And the cost alone for just going through those land use reviews could be upwards of $20,000. So what this proposal does is it does reduce the type of review that is required for a shelter with from a Type 3 to Type 2 in some situations. Generally, if they are using an existing building to put the shelter in, or if it's a site of an existing institution. We also worked on changing some of the approval criteria so that in some cases when the shelter is being proposed in an existing building, the focus is more on livability issue and less on things such as traffic and parking. And then lastly, currently shelters are prohibited in EG zones. What we determined was that all other community service uses were allowed in EG zones, and so we at least change the code to give people the opportunity to apply for a conditional use review in the EG zones. The one thing we did not change was in the OS and industrial zones, open space and industrial zones, shelters are currently prohibited, and we did not necessarily want to change that. There are, of course, a lot of other city policies regarding industrial lands and our recreational opportunities that would have to be amended if we were going to try to start allowing shelters in these zones. For short-term housing, the PSC did not make as many changes. There's fewer barriers of entry generally for short-term housing. In fact, there a lot of times they're allowed in a lot of the commercial zones. But what these changes do is they provide some consistency for the review type between short-term housing and mass shelters. So most of the changes in here, for example, with the conditional use review, in cases where the mass shelter could be a Type 2 conditional use review, we also extended that to apply to short-term housing. And then once again, similar, if a short-term housing was able to be done by right, there wasn't a parking requirement. The last piece I'm going to talk about has to do with transitional housing. This tends to be temporary shelter that is provided on a short-term basis. We currently have an item in our code that allows a religious institution to host one transitional housing unit for up to 60 days. What we found is, and I think the original intent of this was either to host a homeless family or potentially host a refugee family or somebody who has recently moved to the area. What many of our providers have found is that 60 days is often not enough time to find secure housing for that group. There was also a desire with some institutions to expand the number of households they could host. So we, and in discussing with the Planning and Sustainability Commission, they also wanted to extend the types of institutions that would be able to host transitional households. So we've expanded the allowance for allowing transitional housing as an accessory use to apply to not only just religious institutions, but also colleges and schools. The amendments allow up to 6 transitional housing units and increase the duration from 60 days to up to 180 days within a calendar year. And then lastly, as we were going through this analysis, we were also looking at the 2011 City Council resolution that was allowing religious institutions to host up to 4 car camping situations. What we found was actually Oregon by statute has a provision on their books that allows up to 3. So we went ahead and amended the code to allow up to 3, so that would be consistent with the ORS. The 2011 City Council resolution never actually changed the code. One thing that the Planning and Sustainability Commission did not do was they did look at a staff proposal to reduce the type of review for affordable housing projects that met certain Housing Bureau conditions. There's currently a temporary ordinance that was instituted in March to allow those to go through a Type 2X review instead of a Type 3. PSC did not approve making that a permanent amendment to the code. So what this means is that there is a Type 2X option that's on the books through the housing emergency. And at this point, it would return to the current review process once the housing emergency is over. One of the things that the PSC was grappling with was that there were no examples at the time of the hearing that they could compare to see if the Type 2X process was actually more efficient than the Type 3. And so there was a concern about making that a permanent change. There has been, actually just in the last week, a Type 2X proposal that came in. So that is something that will be looked at.
Well, just to add to that quickly, even in this period, affordable housing projects that did come in tactically, when they did their evaluation, chose to do a Type 3. So you had a choice. So they weren't sure of the benefits, but they understood the intent.
So I just wanted to mention, you know, the PSC recognized that these code changes were not the silver bullet to solve homelessness. There are actually a lot of projects that the city is undergoing currently that together will definitely help the situation, but this is just one aspect of it. There are, of course, other, the inclusionary housing project, which you'll be hearing in the future, is another example of finding ways to deal with affordable housing. And then, of course, the Central City Plan and the mixed-use zones project is also looking at provisions related to affordable housing. So this is not, of course, the only bite at the apple. But we did feel that this was something that did address the heart of the matter as far as what the council had asked in terms of finding zoning code situations that help with the process and the regulations for especially for short-term housing and mass shelters. So the PSC did request that the City Council amend Title 33 as shown in their report and adopt the recommended drafts as further findings. And I do want to take this opportunity to also mention that in, over the past week there has been some additional conversation with Commissioner Saltzman's office. They have proposed 3 amendments to the recommended draft. One of those would affect kind of a technical detail on how we look at temporary activities. Second item was related to how we define group housing structures, and the reason to look at that was it was not clear on our definition if something like a series of housing pods that shared a common kitchen on a site would fall under that group housing category. So we made a change that would make that more clear. And the third item that we worked with BDS on that came out of the commissioner's office was to make it a little more clear what the thresholds were and what the approval criteria were for mass shelters and short-term housing, especially in the R zones. We did originally propose 2 different sets of approval criteria, and instead we created a hybrid set of criteria and provided some code language so that an existing shelter could potentially have a small expansion without triggering another conditional use review. So, for example, an existing shelter could maybe add on some storage or expand their lobby area as long as they met the previous conditions of approval.
So where are those amendments?
There should be a memo dated November 2nd that actually is, I think, on our letterhead. But it was, I think what happened was we had some conversations with BDS, and then we turned that into some code amendments.
So, yeah, we'll make sure the council's got copies of those. But, Dan, do you want to go ahead and propose your amendments, and then we'll further discuss this with staff and take testimony? So,
yeah, I think as Phil said, there's three amendments.
Three amendments, quite technical in detail, but I think Phil did a good job. We have Matt Wickstrom here who can go into more detail if anybody wishes, but I would recommend adoption of these amendments.
So you have the description. So the first is to allow permanent alterations at a site of temporary shelter if they're in compliance with code and remain after the site is used as a temporary shelter. Second is clarifying the group living facility requirements about sleeping pods supported by a kitchen and a bathroom, and the third is consolidating conditional use zones into a single criterion. So
is everything in this memo that has a strikeout and is all of this the amendment?
So
how do I determine what's being amended?
Essentially, the piece on section 33285, mm-hmm. that section would replace what's in the recommended draft. However, the strike through and underline is showing what is currently in the code versus what is proposed. So it includes both the recommended draft and the changes. The changes are much more minor than that.
Can you stop right there for a second? If it contains both, how do we know what the amendment is?
It's based on, I guess, our summary of that. So essentially what we did is in 285, we added the option that existing shelters and short-term housing could have a small expansion without triggering a conditional use review, and we changed the reference of what approval criteria would apply.
So it might be useful, just in terms of council discussion, if maybe somebody could highlight that for us.
Right, because what you're looking at is we amended the conditional use criteria, and then we made a small change in response to this. And maybe Phil, you could read pieces.
Let's simplify this, Joe.
Yeah.
Could someone take a highlighter on one copy
and take a copy.
Highlight the changes in Dan's amendment, and we'll circulate it? Because the thing that I think is confusing is you've got all the other red lines.
Yeah.
And there's no way to tell what's the amendment to the amendment, and.
Right.
We don't have the time right now to go through it.
If somebody during the hearing could just, we're going to go ahead and hear from people, but
yeah, we'll take care
of
that.
If you could just, she's got a copy, she'll wing it.
Well, I had the same issue, and so I, before coming to the hearing, did that myself. If that would be useful to loan you my copy,
Yes.
Thank
you. I just want to circulate that so we make sure we know what the words on the page that are different are.
The challenge is that the community hasn't had an opportunity to see that.
That's a problem.
So maybe we could.
I think the good news, Commissioner Fritz, is there's a red line version, which is the Fritz Amendment, change. But without the highlighted, I see. So it's a ton of stuff.
So we may need to continue the hearing.
Yeah. I mean, as we were going through, there was some other edit, kind of technical editing that was done just to make the wording read better with the new language.
All right. Well, why don't we proceed? We've got invited testimony. We've got community testimony, and while we're doing that,
I just want to highlight one more issue. Thank you for working with me over the past several weeks, including with City Attorney Reese, Deputy City Attorney Lindley Reese, to look at, is there any way that mass shelters can be allowed in industrial zones? And I think we've all come to the conclusion, no. So I'm quite fine with the prohibition in industrial zones. Supposing we were to make mass shelters not allowed in open space zones, what process, because not allowed means that there is a process that you could ask for it to be allowed, right? What process might such a proposal go through?
From a use standpoint, there's really just three options. There's allowed, conditionally allowed, or prohibited. So the not allowed versus prohibited standard is usually applicable to development standards, where you could ask for an adjustment to that development standard. So if there was going to be something looked at, it would essentially create a conditional use review process, I guess. The thing that we'd have to take a look at is whether there's approval criteria that are adequate for that and so on. In general, when we took a look at what use categories are allowed in open space zones, it is fairly limited, although other community service uses such as a library or a community center are allowed through a conditional use process as well.
Can I ask a question of you, Amanda, because I want to make sure I'm tracking this. We're talking about potentially a mass shelter in an open space?
Yes.
Could you give us an example just to set the context?
Well, we were recently told, not quite so recently, by the Land Use Board of Appeals that people sheltering in tents are, in fact, mass shelters. So we also know that there is a provision in state law for recreational campgrounds. And that's something I'm going to explore with staff. We didn't. The Land Use Board of Appeals ruling came down in the middle of this project, so we all decided with the mayor's agreement that we were not going to derail this particular project because it's very important to make mass shelter changes. On the other hand, a Right to Dream 2 type of shelter doesn't really fit in any of the categories we've got so far. And indeed, we might at some point find some open space zoned land that we would want to make available for people to have a safe shelter.
So you're previewing a discussion we may have with respect to some future action?
Potentially.
It's not part of this.
It's not part of this. And I was just seeking clarification as to what I had forgotten that the use categories, it's either allowed, conditional use, and prohibited. There's no not allowed like there is in variances for the rest of the zoning code. Thank you.
Other questions for Joe or Phil before we'll probably have others. Great. Once we've gone through the testimony, but let me invite, we've got some panels here that we want to hear from. One is Ryan Divert, Tony Bernal, and Rabbi Kahana. I think you're all here. Yes, you are. Come on up, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Ryan Divert. I work with the City and County's Joint Office for Homeless Services. The Joint Office for Homeless Services was formed to coordinate budgeting, contracting, and policy development roles of the city and county related to ending homelessness. Staff from the Joint Office also coordinate A Home for Everyone, our community-wide effort to house people experiencing homelessness throughout Multnomah County by making smart investments in the areas of housing, income, health, and importantly today, survival and emergency services. One of the early priorities identified by the Home for Everyone Safety Off the Streets work group was to remove barriers to siting shelters and other safety off the streets options for people experiencing homelessness, while we worked diligently toward long-term solutions to homelessness, like expansion of permanently affordable housing. Joint Office staff have worked closely with staff from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to describe the scope of challenges siting mass shelters within the city of Portland and to identify potential improvements to zoning code to address those challenges. The proposed mass shelter and housing zoning code update in front of you today addresses the vast majority of the identified challenges and will make a significant difference in the ability of publicly funded nonprofit and volunteer-led shelter providers to site shelters effectively and efficiently. We genuinely appreciate the work of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability in developing the proposed update, particularly their outreach to various Home for Everyone partners, as well as Neighborhood Coalition and other community groups.
Thanks, Ryan. Tony, welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Tony Bernal, Senior Director of Public Policy and Funding for Transition Projects. I've also served on a Home for Everyone Safety Off the Streets Committee since its inception 2 years ago. As Ryan mentioned, the Safety Off the Streets Committee identified shelter code as a significant barrier to getting people off the streets. In short, code makes it cumbersome and costly to site new shelters. Code also too severely limits the number of people that a shelter may house, with 100 occupants being the maximum in any zone. Under the housing state of emergency and working with the Joint Office of Homeless Services, Transition Projects has opened 3 temporary shelters in the past year. We will open two more this month. It is highly unlikely we would have been able to open even one additional shelter without the flexibility provided to us by the state of emergency. The proposed changes to the code are reasonable and will provide the permanent fix we need to be able to respond swiftly when shelter is needed. I would urge you to support them.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. Thank you for allowing us to be here today. I want to speak, I'm sorry, I didn't identify myself, Rabbi Michael Kahana, Senior Rabbi of Congregation Beth Israel in Northwest Portland. I want to speak particularly to the issues before us relating to religious institutions. Mayor Hales, at the beginning of this crisis, asked religious institutions to step up and do what we can to make a difference during this time. And I believe it's highly appropriate, those of us in the Abrahamic faiths believe that we cannot stand idly by while our neighbor bleeds. And we, many of religious institutions in Portland, are blessed with facilities that have the ability to make some difference. The proposal that's before you has some specific changes that will help us to do a better job in housing when possible. This allows, as you see, for instead of one accessory use home, the ability to have up to six transitional housing units, and the ability to have the average length of stay changed from 60 days to 180 days. They're small changes, but significant changes. We are working, a number of us, and you'll hear about this in just a little while, about the ability to use parking lots in our community as housing areas, to be able to not have people sleeping in cars, which is currently allowed on a limited basis, but to have temporary housing structures that are placed in parking lots. This and other ideas will help to make our spaces make a difference in our community and do a small part in dealing with the current emergency.
Thank you all. Questions? Appreciate very much. Thank you. Thank you for being here and for being part of this effort. Okay. I have another panel to call on, and that's Chris Iosa from Do Good Multnomah and Linda Jo Develmink from Community of Hope. Or substitute. Welcome.
I am Linda Jo Develmink from Community of Hope, and I just want to share my experience of having gone through a conditional use review before the housing crisis was official. It was a very long and expensive and difficult process, and particularly the transportation piece. When we had a parking lot, we had to go through this whole and pay for an official consultant to do a transportation review, which kind of really didn't need to be done, in his opinion. So any way that you can make this easier for other small groups, faith-based or not, who are trying to make a difference, that would be very much appreciated. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good point. Thank you.
Excellent.
Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me. Chris Ayosa, director of Do Good Multnomah. We serve homeless veterans in the greater Portland area. And in the past 12 months, we have partnered with religious institutions to open two new shelters to serve homeless veterans. And again, without the state of the emergency, we believe that this would have been quite a daunting and difficult task. In the past 12 months, we've been able to serve over 175 veterans. A lot of them now are in permanent supportive housing, and we greatly appreciate it. So anything to do to minimize the barriers to opening shelters, transitional housing in these in partnerships with these religious institutions, I think it'd be, you know, fortuitous. I'd also like to push, you know, the fact that not only just looking at maybe emergency shelters and or expanding transitional housing opportunities, I'd also like to possibly expand the option of looking at permanent supportive housing on church properties. There's a lot of churches in Portland that are, you know, ready and able communities that want to serve, that have property, and due to the zoning, it might be a little bit difficult. So I'm just imploring that we also look at that option as well.
Can Can I respond to that for a
please,
second?
Please.
So, you know, there are a lot of historic churches, particularly in the inner core of the city, that are going through big changes with the profile of their congregations. Or that is that, Rabbi, is that an ecumenical term? Okay. And what they have consistently is they have real estate.
Absolutely.
And the idea of marrying housing with a church community that serves as a sponsor and a loving community, or as Avail would say, a beloved community around it, is very appealing. Both, you know, think about older adults living there,
absolutely,
supportive housing, other things. Because we have a shortage of land, I think this concept is going to become more compelling as we go forward. The last time the council took up such an issue was when there was a proposal by a community playhouse to take over a church in Inner Northeast, and it sparked some, you know, debate. But ultimately, a theater company went into an old church. I completely agree with you, though, that that is in the, you know, medium term, a huge opportunity. And is it your sense that there are significant zoning and code barriers to making that happen?
I believe so. Our organization have already spoke to two churches that would be interested, and due to their zoning, it's something that would be an incredibly daunting task.
Well, Mayor, you know, a few years ago when we authorized church camping,
right,
as you recall, there was a huge pushback in certain parts of the city based on some fear about what that would mean and how it's implemented. And obviously we always viewed that as as the best of a worst set of options. No one was ever saying that we want to just say people can live in their car in a church parking lot and we've solved the problem. The building of housing in sacred sites, if you will, I think is a absolute no-brainer. And perhaps at some point, Mayor, we can begin the process of looking at what are the zoning and code challenges to doing that. Because my guess is there are a lot of faith communities that would welcome this, particularly as their congregations are declining. And this is a way to potentially generate some revenue as well as repurposing the site.
Absolutely. Those are the conversations that we've had.
Good stuff.
Great. I think these proposals and Dan's amendments, I think, give us some routes through the thicket, not all the routes we necessarily need. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
And if I could just add, if we hadn't had that expense and that time, we would have increased the capacity of our shelter before now, and we would have been able to maybe to do the rest of the renovations rather than phasing them or have more operating expenses now. Oh, it's tremendous, tremendous impact to have to pay those fees.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate all the panelists. So let's call on any folks that have signed up to speak on this item in addition to those we invited.
I show four more people: Andrew Riley, Madeline Kovacs, and Andy Olson. Please come on up.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I guess we'll get this kicked off. My name is Andrew Riley. I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator with 1000 Friends of Oregon, and I'm just here to represent my organization's support for the proposal in front of you today. You have my written testimony, so I won't read it at you, but I'll just highlight a few key points. One, we're here for the same reason that I think everyone else is, and that's the 4,000 members of our community who are sleeping on the street every night. We think that demands moral action. We think that demands creative action. We think that's exactly what this package of code changes does. This is one of those kind of proposals that started strong and has gotten stronger as the process has gone through, and I just want to call out three amendments at the Planning and Sustainability Commission level that we think are really worthy of your support and attention. First is, again, this maximum number of allowed beds in each zone. We think it's really calibrated to the size of a shelter that each zone can sustain and is consistent with good land use. Relaxing what is frankly an absurd applicability of parking minimums to shelters. I know not everyone on the council is sold on this idea, but we think that's a good step on the long term to eliminating parking minimums entirely. And finally, this expansion of institutional uses to encompass more institutions and really allow more beds over more days. We think that that is a really excellent opportunity for religious institutions and others who are looking to support communities. So we think that as amended, this is a really excellent proposal, a good chance to address the fact that we are frankly out of shelter beds in Portland. We urge your support.
Andrew, can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Because you were a close observer of a number of things we did a few years ago. Why did we not get any traction on the proposal to allow churches in to activate their parking and provide interim shelter for more people?
You know, I'll be honest, on the shelter question, I'm a little newer to the issue, so I don't have the historical background on that one.
I actually could comment on that, Commissioner, because I appreciated when you brought it forward, and I knew you had. So when I was in charge of development services, I would get people from the county asking me, where could this happen? And we connected them very quietly because of the reaction that we got when we did it.
In Southeast?
Yes, in the Southeast. I just gently connected them to friendly church communities, and it is happening.
Yeah, I think one of the answers is there was a lot of misinformation about what was happening. And I think people were concerned there was unsupervised activity and other kinds of things. And when people are uncertain, they react a certain way. Maybe we didn't do such a great job then communicating what was allowed and why and what levels of safeguards were being placed in terms of the responsibility of the church or faith community and others. So, anyway. How long have you been in your new gig?
About 5 months, so pretty new.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. Thank you for listening to all of us this afternoon and making the time. My name is Madeline Kovacs, for the record, and I am the coordinator of Portland for Everyone, which is a project of Thousand Friends of Oregon. We support the mass shelter and housing code update as amended unanimously by the Planning and Sustainability Commission. We also support those key changes that need to be made, as identified by the PSC and outlined by my colleague, Andrew. Portland's housing crisis, and in particular the 4,000 unhoused Portlanders on our streets every night, demand action. Just over a year ago, Portland City Council made a historic stride towards taking action proportional to the challenge when it declared a housing state of emergency. The mass shelter and housing code update has the potential to be a truly creative, well-tailored policy solution addressing the dire need facing Portlanders. We must also address housing challenges confronting our city by taking action at multiple levels simultaneously. We need inclusionary zoning to right past exclusionary wrongs and pursue truly mixed income neighborhoods, strong implementation of the anti-displacement goals and policies recently adopted into the comprehensive plan update, ability to leverage fees appropriately on new development, bond measures to raise funds for permanently affordable housing, flexible zoning and building codes that allow more families to live in smaller, space-efficient, and budget-efficient homes close to transit, amenities, and services, prioritization of home ownership for low-income families and families of color that have been shut out of these opportunities to build community wealth and put down roots, allowance of self-determined organizing efforts like Dignity Village, and an end to no-cause evictions and other protections that can support the basic rights of renters, and probably more. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi. Andy Olson. Back in May of this year, Commissioner Saltzman and Chair Kifuri challenged the private sector to get involved with addressing the issue of houselessness. On October 9th, in the rain at Castaways in Northwest Portland, 54 volunteers began work on 4 8x8 shelter pods to be donated for use by Portland's houseless community. After 4 days of hard work, they were transported to the Rebuilding Center to be completed. One of the pods has been donated to the new 501c3 created by Hazelnut Grove and will be sited there next week. Two of the pods will be transported this Friday to the parking lot at Congregation Beth Israel to serve as display homes for this new form of shelter. One pod is looking for a home in the parking lot of a faith-based organization. The pod is homeless at the moment, hopefully. We can do something about that. Our group has been thrilled with the response from business community, the TIVNU program, Constructing Hope, Oregon tradeswomen, and especially want to point out the amazing support and participation of the Rebuilding Center. Stay tuned for more efforts to address houselessness from the private sector and the faith-based community. One thing I'd like to ask is for Commissioner Novick to meet with our group to talk about mitigating the street parking issues that will be occurring when congregations give up scarce parking spaces for shelter pods. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all very
Absolutely.
Much. We were just talking this morning, by the way, about the fact that Blanche House has got a grant to produce 30 pods, so we got to find a place for them somewhere, we as a community. Maybe there's 31 homeless pods at the moment, so soon there will be more. We have other folks signed up?
I show one more person, Ian Slingerland.
Come on. And anyone else that would like to speak on this item, come on up as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mayor, Commissioners, Ian Slingerlin. I'm the Director of Homeless Initiatives for Home Forward. In addition to Home Forward's role providing housing and assistance to people leaving homelessness, our executive director sits on the executive committee for A Home for Everyone. And I'm here today to briefly share Home Forward's support for the proposed changes to the zoning code affecting mass shelter and short-term housing. While recognizing the scale of the crisis we face and without understanding the amount of work that remains, at Home Forward, we've been very encouraged by the impact to date of our coordinated and collaborative efforts through A Home for Everyone. And we fully embrace our shared commitment through A Home for Everyone to increase options for safety and a good night's sleep for people experiencing homelessness in our community, including through an expansion of our community's shelter options. We believe the changes being considered today will facilitate our community's ability to achieve the goals established through A Home for Everyone and would ask you to adopt them. In particular, we believe the changes being considered are an important step forward for two reasons. First, there's an unprecedented awareness in our community of the housing and homelessness crisis we face, particularly when it comes to the people throughout our city experiencing unsheltered homelessness. It is our hope that this unprecedented awareness can translate into unprecedented engagement in addressing the problems our city faces. Making changes like this one, like the ones before you, we believe that limit barriers to solutions-focused engagement are incredibly important, and we hope will facilitate involvement of additional, perhaps less resourced, private nonprofit and faith-based groups. And I'm encouraged by the additional conversation that's happened here today, that there's opening to continue to look at ways that we can as jurisdictions and public agencies be welcoming partners for folks who are looking to be engaged in our efforts to end homelessness. Second, we believe these changes will create opportunities for greater efficiency in shelter operations and will reduce the burdens associated with and the capacity necessary to open new shelter and short-term housing options. And when we reduce the burdens associated with opening and operating shelters, we increase our capacity to do other things like place people from shelter into housing, which is the end goal for all of this. So thank you for considering these changes, and thanks to the work that city staff have done moving this forward.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Yes, my name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Watchdog PDX. I do support the proposed changes, and again, the efforts made by Multnomah County on placing shelters, what I consider farther out from the city center, I think has been very advantageous. And not only it shows that it can work, and the reality is that we don't need to have a central city hub for all the shelters. And a lot of people think, well, all the services are possibly located in Old Town, Chinatown, but that's not correct. We have plenty of transportation to get to and from. And the reality is that if you look what Chair Kafori is doing by placing a lot of these shelters in other locations, is actually kind of relieving the pressure on the services that used to really be relied upon in Old Town, Chinatown. And you're beginning to notice a real difference on the sidewalks on just how many people are there. And it's really beginning to decrease because these shelters, a lot of the people want to live farther out. They want to live in different locations, and they should be given that opportunity. And so the reality by this study that we're seeing and what's happening is that it does work. They still have good services. They still can come downtown and have a good time around the city, and they still have the option to go out a little bit further. And by doing that, it will open up more properties with the proper zoning and also allow people to still have the services. And that needs to be looked at very close. Now, another issue on the 200 units, I think that's within reason. Again, some of these shelters I don't think can really operate over 100 efficiently. But when we look at the overall city itself, operating efficiency for the city benefits all the people, not just the homeless, not just the business owners, not just people coming into town. Because when we have more people in a more safe shelter, housing for health, the city benefits. The city runs more efficiently. The businesses create more income that can fund into the services. It is better to have people into shelters or permanent housing than to have them on sidewalks. And we know that from a safety issue, from their health standpoint. So we need to keep focusing. The city that runs the most efficient takes care of the homeless the best, and it decreases homelessness throughout the city. And if we don't focus on running the city overall efficiently, then we will have problems on having too many people in certain areas, which I think shouldn't be happening in today's city. Thank you.
Thank you. Afternoon.
Well, I had, Mr. Shedrick, I had a, the industrial nature of Terminal 1, I really have questions about that, because homeless people, when they're sleeping on sidewalks, are exposed to carbon dioxide fumes, monoxide fumes. Rain is toxic to a homeless person and invokes pneumonia. If you're sleeping on the grass in a park, they could have just put down pesticides. And you should be really relaxed about that. I mean, I think at Terminal 1, they just could have laid down some plastic and some, four-by-eight boards to buffer the people, or rent overhead fans to ventilate it. Just environmental reasons. Also, I would have thought, too, at Terminal 1, they might have actually paid some of the people to help to clean up the toxic stuff under the concrete, and they might have learned something. So there could be ways to teach homeless people as an apprenticeship program how to clean up a toxic building as a job skill. And but I'm just saying, in the future, because of the exposure to chemicals, you should use there's what I call a non-background argument. You're using an argument that this is toxic and nothing else is. And a lot of things outdoors are toxic.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else that wants to speak on this item? And other questions for staff before we go back to Dan's amendments, or maybe while
let's
we go back to
let's
Dan's?
Go back. Mayor, if someone, Dan's amendments, I think they're more complicated. When you look at the handout, I think they're more complicated than actually they are. So maybe if someone could just restate in plain English what the proposal is, I'd be willing to.
It's also coming back for second reading next week. Yeah. So
well, and we so we've got copies highlighted, and Phil can walk you through it.
All right, why don't you walk us through it this afternoon?
It's simpler than the format seems.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I think the easiest thing to do is to focus on one specific section, because the same language repeats in several areas, and that's why it looks like it's several, more involved than it really is. But if you, as an example, if you wanted to turn to the page 4 of the code amendments, which you'll see about halfway down, it'll say B, mass shelters.
Yep.
You'll see the stuff that's highlighted in orange. Essentially, they involve two things. The changes were looking at what conditional use approval criteria apply. It shows in any case it's 33.8.15.107 in that case. Previously, we had two different sets of approval criteria that would apply depending on whether it was an institution or whether it was an existing building. And so we created one set of conditional approval criteria that are hybrid. And then the second piece that we sort of highlighted on this is this idea that an existing shelter that expanded up to 10% potentially would not have to go through a new review, a conditional use review. And so those are the kind of things that they repeated in each zone, in each situation.
So this is building area 10%.
Right.
So if we have a 20,000 square foot building that houses no homeless people today, but we're not expanding its building area, this doesn't come to bear?
Well, it would have to already be a mass shelter. So this applies to existing mass shelters.
Ah, okay.
A new mass shelter would still be subject. If it was in an existing building, it would potentially go through a type 2 review.
Right.
If it was going to build a brand new building, then it would go through the type 3 review with a hearing.
And Joe, what do you think of these amendments?
We crafted them and support them.
Okay. All right.
Okay. And so the other main change is just in the conditional use review chapter, which would be on page 7 and 8. Because we were combining two sets of conditional use approval criteria, we wanted some of the things that were in the other criteria to apply to mass shelter that was expanding. So if a mass shelter is expanding, or is not in an existing building, we did want them to look at things like physical compatibility and public services. So this is, once again, kind of hybridizing the approval criteria.
Yeah. So while we're on page 7, let's return to the question that was brought up by Linda Jo, as well as mentioned earlier, and that is transportation demand analysis for a shelter. It says that you have to have a finding that the transportation system is capable of supporting the proposal in addition to existing uses in the area. Look at street capacity, level of service, access to arterials, connectivity, transit availability, on-street parking impacts, access restriction, neighborhood impacts, impacts on pedestrian, bicycle, and transit circulation, safety for all modes, and adequate transportation management, demand management strategies. That's a lot. And I could fairly stipulate, and I bet she would agree, that most congregations are not set up to do that kind of technical analysis, so then they got to go hire a consultant to do it. While we're in the neighborhood, should we prune a little bit here?
We'll make it just for a certain size.
Actually, I was going to direct you to the introductory paragraph for 107.
Okay.
So essentially, in a case such as hers, or in a case where, say, a religious institution wants to put a shelter within an existing building, they would generally just have to meet criterion A and C.
Ah, okay.
Portion of household living uses and the livability. And that was what the old provision was. And then otherwise, if they are going to increase by either more than 1,500 square feet or 10%, whichever is greater, then they have to look at these things such as physical compatibility and the public services. So the idea is if you're adding the square footage, I mean, then you may have an impact on how, especially in a residential zone, of what that new building and or expansion looks like from a compatibility standpoint, and also the type of services you might need.
So this really does solve the problem she was describing.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. I hadn't understood that the 1,500 square foot threshold. So that's appropriately generous, I think.
Okay, good.
And for the record, I don't have any problems with that either, despite my usual insistence on parking. I think we did get some testimony from the University Park Neighborhood Association saying that they wanted to continue to have some parking requirements, but I don't believe that's necessary. I did want to go through some of the other things I read in testimony. There was a suggestion about, or concern about, using the employment zone in EG, now allowing some of these facilities there, from James Peterson in Multnomah. Did you see that?
Yes. And so the consideration of EG, it's an employment general zone, under our new code that you guys are reviewing through the comprehensive plan right now, we're moving to protecting jobs in that zone by not allowing residential anymore. However, this is a community service use. Community service use, we think, is appropriate to allow an EG as a conditional use. There is a lot of EG in the city, so it's actually a move that, even though it's still a conditional use, opens up a wider range of sites. And so we understand the concern. However, there's a conditional use process before it can be established. And if we were going to have a wholesale run on EG land to open shelters, I think we would all consider it a success.
Yeah, that's a good point. The one concern...
May I just ask one question related to that?
Mm-hmm.
But it's still queued to the declaration of emergency, correct?
This would be a permanent change. But essentially, most community service uses, and actually most community service uses are allowed in EG. So actually,
No time limit.
Right, and so this provides, so for example, there might be a job placement or other kind of community service use that might want to locate an EG, but may want to also offer a temporary shelter opportunity or mass shelter opportunity. This at least provides the opportunity to apply for a conditional use review.
So you have community service uses allowed today, just not these particular ones.
And could you remind me how, for the temporary activities, how long can a temporary activity keep going?
So what we placed in the actual use categories was a maximum limit of 180 days in a calendar year, and that is actually dictated mostly by building code requirements. The intent on this is for either a school or a religious institution to be able to host a household or a group of households without necessarily triggering change of occupancy and making sure that, you know, they have, you know, bedrooms that meet code and so on. And essentially, from a building code standpoint, if they spend more than 180 days with that activity within a year, they would be looking at that as being a permanent.
And within the housing state of emergency, the only everything's waived except for this temporary activities segment, right?
Well, with that housing emergency, I think there's all of it's waived.
No, I think that the temporary activities is still there, which is why you're proposing the change that alterations to existing developments consistent with development standards should be allowed.
I think it's just that the housing emergency is lasting longer than 180 days. So I think there's some acknowledgement amongst development services that certain, you know, emergency shelters that may have been put in place may be running longer than that time period.
Okay. And then the letter from the University Park Neighborhood Association, the one concern that I wondered about or shared is about using it for student housing, that institutions might use this as a backdoor way to make
the less expensive. If you remember in an earlier slide, and actually I have another slide that I could provide, but the thing to keep in mind is short-term housing and mass shelters are intended for folks to stay there less than 30 days. So student housing, even if somebody's staying there for a quarter or semester, they're staying there longer than 30 days. That is looked at as a group living type of facility. And so they would be subject to those regulations, which, of course, like at University of Portland, that is part of the dorm housing piece. And as the way our code is provided, even if, since the zone that University of Portland is in, even if they were willing to do something under a short-term mass shelter piece, they would only be able to do up to 15 beds by right, which is fairly minimal for that area. So if they wanted to do something more on a 30 days or less basis, they'd still have to go through conditional use review.
So practically, these doesn't work for student housing.
As usual, you've read the concerns and figured out what needs to be done, what doesn't. Thank you.
Other questions? So are we ready to take action on Commissioner Saltzman's amendments as a package?
Yeah, I'll second them as a package.
All right, then let's vote on those, please.
Novick?
Thank you for the clear explanation. Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman. Aye.
Right. So, Commissioner, I hope you will post these on your website, because obviously they weren't published ahead of time, so that if community members do have concerns about them, they can get in touch with us before the vote next week. I appreciate the amendments. I think they're positive. Aye.
Yes.
Thanks to staff for highlighting the changes. It's, I guess, the challenge of compound redlining in a single document, but it's clearer. And thank you, Dan. Aye.
Saltzman?
Thanks, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and Bureau of Development Services for helping to craft these amendments and giving good explanations. So, and we will post them on my website. Aye.
Bales.
I appreciate your leadership on this, Dan. And again, thanks to the bureaus for good work under pressure. It's not like these two bureaus aren't otherwise busy, as I mentioned earlier. I also want to thank the advocacy from the community and the folks that came here to testify today. Particularly nice having 1,000 friends weighing in on issues like this. A long time ago, at the beginning of my career, I used to sue local governments with 1,000 friends, not this one, for not doing their share on housing. So it's a little deja vu moment for me to see 1,000 friends weighing in on housing access for all, and I appreciate it. So these amendments make a good proposal better. I'm glad that the Planning and Sustainability Commission also did that. And so this is exactly where we need to be. I appreciate the good work. Aye. And it is coming back next week for second reading and final
Mayor,
action.
May I suggest, I talked to staff about a couple of very minor conforming amendments to the ordinance itself, because the ordinance in directives A and B refer to a particular report on a particular date. Could we simply have somebody move and second to add to directives A and B as amended by council so that it's clear?
Okay. Given that. Can I have a motion to that effect now? You want to do it now? Okay.
Second.
Okay, roll call on that clarifying technical amendment.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
This is really great teamwork. Thank you very much for making sure that we do it correctly. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hale.
Aye. Okay, and now it will come back next week for second reading. Thank you very much. And we have another time certain item this afternoon, but we uncharacteristically allowed too much time, so we're going to take a 30-minute break and return for that item. Then.
Nice.
It's usually the other way around. Yeah, right.